Content for the following program was provided by the Teton County Library.
Hey, everybody, turn off the TV. Meet me down at the library.
From the back of the stacks.
Library, library, library.
Welcome to the back of the stacks. I'm your host, Rebecca. Today I'm joined by Leah. Leah organizes our adult programs at the library, always bringing interesting topics. And I'd say you're often on top of current trends. And so I always like to see what you're reading. And one of the books you've been talking about for a while is Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind by Yuval Noah Harari. And I was not surprised to learn that you're on trend as usual and that this book is really popular at the library. And there are several people waiting with it on hold to get it into their hot little hands. So
his second book is called Homo Deus, which is, its subtitle is A Brief History of Tomorrow. And so it's about where we go from here, what happens in the future of humanity. And he suggests that there's going to be different subhuman species, which he opens up Sapiens with, how we used to live with lots of other humans like Homo erectus, Neanderthals, all at the same time. And it's a misnomer that we literally evolved from apes to Homo sapiens and we were the only humans on the planet. But no, we coexisted simultaneously with many other human species.
And is it also a misnomer that we were like the best, the smartest, the most adaptable humans that made it, the tree branch that made it, or we were just lucky?
No, it is true that we are top of the food chain, and we right now continue to be top of the food chain. And so Sapiens is a story in how we got there. How did we wipe all the other humans out? And so it's a cool, riveting story. He's a very good storyteller. So he explains that the reason why Homo sapiens in particular, even though we are physically not strong and vulnerable, we stand upright, we have soft skin, our babies are very vulnerable, they take a long time to parent. Neanderthals were much bigger and stronger than us. How were we able to literally wipe them out? And he says that we have genocide wired into our DNA because we've wiped out all of our subhuman species. But he says that the one factor that set us apart was that not only do we have language abilities, because the other humans had language as well, we have this ability to create fictions and to create myths and stories. And what that allows is large groups of strangers to cooperate with each other. And he gives an example that if you get 100 gorillas together, they're not going to band together and create a government. And you won't be able to ask a gorilla to give up all its bananas for you in the promise that after he dies, he will go to heaven. So he says that humans were able to do that and create these fictions and these stories to get people to believe things.
And then what's the benefit of getting everybody to believe the same story?
Basically, it's cooperation. And cooperation stories and myths could look like government or religion, or he says like the one myth that all cultures believe in is money.
How is money a myth?
So he separates like things that happen, that occur biologically exist, but things that don't occur biologically. And he says you can ask yourself, will this suffer? Is like a test to see if it's something that exists or if it's a story. And he says money is a myth because it's not going to suffer and it doesn't exist in nature and we create it. So like as a metaphor for bananas, like apes won't create money and say, here's this worthless piece of paper, give me 10 bananas. But humans do it because we believe in the story that this dollar bill is worth 10 bananas. Whereas it's just a piece of paper that we have decided is worth 10 bananas or a book or a CD or whatever, but it's not intrinsically represents these things and it's interchangeable.
And is it also about trust, that we trust that this piece of paper is worth 10 bananas, or, you know, you can use it in multiple settings. It's also worth I don't know, 10 oranges and 10 apples.
Exactly. Like, when money is, the chapter on money is really fascinating because a lot of people just take for granted that we understand what money is, but we really don't. Like, if we do, we understand it as this thing that we just make up and we all believe in it and we all choose to trust that we're believing in it. And he says that, yes, that there is a lot of trust and it's not so easy. You're like, oh, I'm just going to create a story and make thousands of people follow me. And it's, he says it's not that easy. Like, to get people to believe in your story is actually quite difficult. So the fact that humans have been able to keep doing this on many different levels is pretty phenomenal. And he does also say that they don't know why. There is nobody knows why we were able to do this with our brains. Like, it was just a fluke, or we don't understand what caused this fluke. So that still is a missing link and piece that scientists, historians, archaeology experts are trying to unravel.
Well, and it seems like now we're actually able to tell stories on a global scale. And so we're able to build cooperation on a global scale. And it's not just sort of that myth that holds your town together or your church together or your neighborhood together. Like, you know, now people are building these virtual neighborhoods or these interest groups that all revolve around one interest, and you're able to connect across oceans. And so it's sort of, our fictions and our myths seem even more powerful now that we're all connected through the internet and social media.
Exactly. Like, when I read the book, I was struck by how when you're given this theory, like, okay, all these things are stories that we make up, and then you're able to see the seams of all of these huge complex issues. Like, okay, these are stories, and why are people believing in them? And he says things that a lot of readers could think is totally blasphemous. Like, he says, equal rights and human rights is a myth. And what he means by that is it does not exist in nature. It is a story that humans have made up. And why it's a good story and a lot of people believe in it is because it does allow a lot of people to cooperate and to get along, and it does further society. But dictatorships are also a myth that has been successful.
Reviewers say that he punctures some of our dearly held beliefs. So is that an example of one of those dearly held beliefs, that these things we believe so strongly in, he's classifying as myths? Or are there other places that you see him sort of puncturing our ideas about our story about human progress?
Oh, he does do that the whole book. You just go, whoa. And I found myself having to reread chapters to make sure that I understood what these arguments are so that I could repeat them when I'm talking to somebody at a cocktail party. Like, oh my God, I just read this book and you have to know this. Like, he has this interesting chapter on imperialism in Europe and the creation of the term progress. And you think, like, oh, progress is something that we've always had and it's always had a definition. And since humanity existed, it's like evolution, but not necessarily. Like, so those kinds of concepts. Or The other one that was just completely interesting to me was the agricultural revolution, where he basically says that humans or Homo sapiens were so much happier as hunter-gatherers, and we had so much more free time. We didn't spend all of our time working. But then once we started planting crops and our lives became more miserable and we were a slave to our crops and we had to tend to them and we didn't have as much free time and there was lots of famine, and yet we were able to grow our populations. So there's this kind of paradox about it. And he talks about how on one hand it looks like we thrived because we could now control our food source, but in other ways we totally diminished our quality of life. And then he says he does have a theory that perhaps the wheat plant itself tricked us into the agricultural revolution.
Whoa.
It's really good.
You mentioned talking about this book at cocktail parties, and I think that's one of the reasons I was excited to ask you about it, because it came out in 2015, and it's interesting that it's still getting a lot of checkouts at the library and seems very popular. And I wonder if that isn't a little bit because of people are talking about it at cocktail parties. And you've read it a while ago, but it's really a book that stayed with you. And
yeah, I heard about it actually from two friends who separately recommended it to me within the same week. And then I was going on a trip. And so I said, okay, so I'll read this book. And I actually had borrowed Harari's second book at the time because I was like, oh, because I read an article in The Atlantic with an interview with Harari about the post-human world. And I thought I wanted to start there. I want to start in tomorrow. I don't need to. I already know the history of humankind. What more is there to know? And it was completely riveting when I had my first layover in Salt Lake and probably read 70 pages. But the first friend that recommended the book said he listened to an audio version while he was gardening. I didn't listen to the audio, but I read the hardback book. And I would think the audio is great, but you might miss, I don't know how they explain it in the audiobook, but there's a lot of graphs and charts and photos, which I thought were very intriguing and interesting, like photos of recreations of Neanderthals and Homo erectus and what they would look like, maps that showed like the migration of the human species around the globe, and just other charts of how society's myths have changed. And so I thought the graphs were pretty useful.
Are you getting ready to read his second book, or did you end up reading that second book?
I've started it a couple times and I haven't finished it, but yeah, I'm planning to read it.
Is it not as riveting?
The end of Sapiens kind of is kind of the beginning of Homo Deus. But it does stretch your imagination because it's kind of this post-human world where he says once again we'll be living with, like what I said in the beginning, living with other subhuman species, where we'll be able to not necessarily have immortal life, but we'll have amortal life. We'll be able to extend our human life longer than what we have now, because he says that what kills us is like our body parts wear out. Or for most of us, that's what kills us. We just get older and old age kills us. But so we'll be able to create new hearts and create new arms and create new body parts and just attach them to us. And so nothing will wear out. And
we'll then 3D print our hearts.
The 3D print our hearts. If you get hit by a car, there's nothing you can't replace that. But he says things like our risk management tolerance will be completely different. We'll have to restructure marriage because who's going to be expected to be married to somebody for 100 years? And the whole family unit will change. And so all these different things. So you think of it, just pushes your imagination into what could happen. And it's really cool.
Thanks for joining us, Leah. I look forward to reading both books. And I was leaning toward the audio book, but you've convinced me to go old school on this and get the hardback copy.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Hey, everybody, turn off the TV. Meet me down at the library.